It's 14 past 8 on Radio National Breakfast. 40 years ago, the graduate's Benjamin Braddock was advised that plastics were his future.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics. There's a great future in plastics.
Had that right. There sure was a great future in plastics, from blood bags to shopping bags, from children's toys to credit cards. We're never far from it, are we? In fact, it's estimated we've produced more plastic in the last decade than in the entire 20th century. Susan Frankel is a science writer and author of a new book called Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Susan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You've spent many years now researching plastic, its history, its scientific makeup, the way we use it, the chain of where it goes once it's produced. Why did you decide to zero in on plastic?
Well, I live in San Francisco in the U.S., where there's been a lot of debate and discussion about it, and it got me thinking about, you know, how significant is plastic really in our lives? And I talk in the book about doing this little experiment where I decided I'd go a day without touching anything plastic, and that sort of fell apart moments into the appointed morning when I walked into my bathroom and looked at the plastic toilet seat, and I realized, you know, it really is just this ubiquitous material that has profoundly, the more I looked at it, the more it was clear to me, it really has profoundly shaped the way in which we live today, and I thought there were a lot of interesting elements to that.
When did the world first become plasticized?
You know, plastics have been around since the mid-19th century, but they didn't really take hold until after World War II, which is when the big petrochemical companies that had been developing new kinds of plastics turned from using those plastics in military applications to consumer markets. And that's when you started to get first plastics going into durable goods, you know, everything from refrigerators to cars to televisions, and then into more sort of single-use disposable conveniences like the shopping bag.
And in the book, you zero in on a few key items, I guess, to get some kind of control to this thing. As you say, plastic is ubiquitous. You look at the Frisbee, the comb, the plastic bag, the credit card. Why did you choose those four things?
Well, those are four of the eight items I looked at. And what I was doing, I wanted to tell sort of the history of plastics and look at this story of this material that has been such a transformative effect on people's lives. And I wanted to find objects that would allow me to tell different facets of that. So the comb, for instance, was one of the first things made from early plastics. And because thanks to plastic, combs went from being made from scarce natural materials like ivory or tortoiseshell to plastic, which made them much more widely available and kind of democratized consumer goods. I looked at the lighter, disposable lighter, as a way to talk about the rise of the culture of disposability, because a lighter is something that absolutely you cannot reuse it, you cannot refill it, you can only throw it away. I looked at the blood bag because that's something that has sort of illustrated the double sword of plastics. On the one hand, they've been a great boon to medicine, but because some plastics, like the vinyl used in blood bags, leach chemicals that may be hormone disruptors, they also have introduced new kinds of health risks to people. So each item was a way to explore a facet of this broad, huge story.
The story of the comb is interesting, and it goes to, you know, why plastic changed our lives. As you say, combs used to be made of ivory, things like that, and plastic was seen as a solution to stop the use or the exploitation of these valuable natural resources, to stop the killing of elephants for the ivory, that sort of thing. I was struck by something in the book. In the 1940s, pollsters found that cellophane was considered one of the most beautiful words in the English language after mother and memory. So there was a real global love affair with plastic.
It was. People were enthralled with plastics at first, and you can understand why. I mean, if you think that we've spent most of humankind, you know, being limited with the natural materials at hand and what they can and can't do, suddenly we have this, family of materials that allow us to sort of engineer our material world in ways that we never were able to do before and do pretty amazing things. You could stop a bullet with plastic, the Kevlar and, you know, vest. You can create transparent materials like cellophane. Unfortunately, there are downsides to many of the plus sides as well.
And the downsides are what a friend of mine for many of us. In many cases, plastic is a dirty word. It's a negative. Even by the 70s, you know, it was the stuff of pink flamingos, of shiny suits. It was synonymous with fake, wasn't it? It looks plastic.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that line from The Graduate, it had become, I think it started to enter the English language as kind of a pejorative word starting in the 60s. And certainly by the 70s, it had acquired this kind of lousy reputation, some of which is well-deserved, some of which is very justified. There have been a lot of schlocky things made out of plastic, and plastic has definite environmental problems and potential health problems associated today.
And even just saying it that way underestimates the extent of those problems. When you look at the landfill, when you look about that island of plastic floating out in oceans around the world that ships can't make their way through, it's so dense and intense. I mean, that's horrific side effect of this product.
It is horrific, although that's a little bit of a misrepresentation and oddly actually underplays the problem, because what you have out in those areas in the oceans mm-hmm. where plastic is concentrated are not big floating islands. What you have is, imagine a swimming pool that's sprinkled all the way through with sort of a confetti of plastic, little tiny plastic bits. And that's worse than a floating island, because you could lasso a floating island and haul it back to shore. You can't scoop those little bits out of the ocean.
Sure, maybe island is the wrong descriptor, but if you've seen the images, it's a massive area.
It absolutely is a massive area, but what fills that area for the most part is this kind of confetti, kind of tiny little specks which are eaten by fish and unfortunately do seem to absorb and concentrate pollutants, toxic pollutants that are already in seawater. So they become a vehicle for not only hurting animals but potentially carrying those chemicals back up the food chain to humans.
And I know your book is not a great defense of plastic. It's an explanation of it, where it came from, how we use it, and the future of it. But there is a really strong message in the book, which is, for all of us, it's a consumer message. The issue perhaps is not plastic, but about how we use it and how we dispose of it, and single use in particular. We can change this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that consumers need to do a better job how we use plastic. I don't think anybody gets off the hook in my book, though, because I think also manufacturers need to take more responsibility for disposing of the things they put into the marketplace, and I think governments have a role to play in tougher both environmental and health laws to ensure that safer chemicals get used. Plastic is potentially great stuff, but it's often made and used in misguided and sometimes dangerous ways.
Hence the title of the book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Susan Frankel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Susan Frankel, and her book about plastic is published by Text Publishing. It's 21 past 8.